WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Don Hewitt, the veteran TV producer-director who created the CBS News magazine 60 Minutes, died this week at the age of 86. In a few minutes, we'll listen to Terry's 2001 interview with Hewitt. But first, our TV critic David Biancooley, who considers Hewitt one of the seminal figures in the history of television news.
Don Hewitt didn't invent the TV news magazine, but he sure invented the most successful and durable one. He created 60 Minutes in 1968, 41 years ago. And like the signature stopwatch that has opened every hour since the beginning, it's still ticking. In fact, this Sunday's 60 Minutes will be devoted entirely to Don Hewitt. And the problem won't be filling the hour, but narrowing it down to one. On camera, there are two figures in TV news who rise above all others, Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. Murrow invented and set the standards for television news at CBS, and Cronkite exemplified them in the 1960s and beyond. Off camera, Don Hewitt worked with them both. Not only worked with them, but predated them and outlasted them. His career, like his impact on television news, is unparalleled. Start with 60 Minutes, his most enduring legacy. The show has ranked in TV's top 10 in several different decades and has ranked a handful of times as television's most popular show. No other news magazine has achieved a number one ranking for the season even once. And the show's popularity, while definitely skewing older in audience appeal, isn't in the past. Last week's installment, featuring the first post-prison TV interview with Michael Vick, was the week's second most popular program. That's an amazing track record for a show that premiered in 1968. But Don Hewitt, who created 60 Minutes, has a track record that is even more amazing. It took 10 years for 60 Minutes to finish in TV's top 10. And by the time it did, Don Hewitt already had been at CBS News for 30 years. And he'd stay there for another 25 years, until he retired from 60 Minutes in 2003. Don Hewitt is like the Forrest Gump or the Zelig of TV news. Whenever something important happened, no matter what year, Hewitt was likely to be there. When CBS began presenting a nightly newscast in 1948 with Douglas Edwards as the anchor, Don Hewitt was an associate director and soon became the program's director. And when Edward R. Murrow made a wary but brilliant transition from radio to television, in 1951's landmark CBS News magazine See It Now, Don Hewitt was at his side, literally, as Murrow explained at the start of the very first show.
This is an old team trying to learn a new trade. When we started this series of programs, we had to decide where to do it from. We decided to do it right here from the studio. My purpose will be not to get in your light any more than I can, to lean over the cameraman's shoulder occasionally and say a word which may help to illuminate or explain what is happening. We have here two monitors, which will serve in effect the purpose of loudspeakers. They are tied, so to speak, to lines that come in from Chicago, New York, Washington, various other places. We will, from time to time, show film on those monitors as well. We are, as newcomers to this medium, rather impressed by the whole thing. Impressed, for example, that I can turn to Don Hewitt here and say, Don, will you push a button and bring in the Atlantic Coast?
And at that point, Don Hewitt was just getting started. In 1952, he directed TV coverage of the national political conventions. In 1956, when the luxury liner the Andrea Doria sank at sea and CBS dispatched a helicopter to film the only TV footage of its sinking, Don Hewitt was manning the camera. In 1960, Hewitt was the director for the unprecedented and politically crucial televised presidential campaign debates between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy. In 1963, when Kennedy was assassinated, Hewitt directed the massive nonstop days of coverage for CBS, the coverage that made Walter Cronkite a TV icon. And so on, up to and including Bill and Hillary Clinton's campaign-saving 1992 appearance on 60 Minutes. Arguably, Don Hewitt influenced the elections of JFK in 1960 and Bill Clinton 32 years later. And Hewitt's career didn't end there. But it's not just the durability or the impact that impresses me, though both of those do impress me. More than anything else, what's most incredible about Don Hewitt's accomplishments is the quality. Almost everything he directed, everything he touched, was impressive and presented with a clear respect for the audience. When Walter Cronkite died earlier this summer, many expressed regret that we'll never see his kind again in TV news. Sad to say, but the same thing is true of Don Hewitt.
David Bianculli writes for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches television and film at Rowan University. Terry Gross spoke to Don Hewitt in 2001, when his memoir called Tell Me a Story was published. They talked about some of his earlier days in television, including his work producing and directing the Nixon-Kennedy debates in 1960. The conventional wisdom is that Nixon fared poorly not because of what he said, but how he looked on television. Terry asked Don Hewitt how Nixon ended up looking the way he did.
Well, first of all, Kennedy took it very seriously. Jack Kennedy and I had a meeting in a hangar in Chicago a week before the debate. He stopped there on a campaign trip, and I briefed him on all the things that we expected of him and what we were going to do and what we wanted him to do. I never saw Nixon until he walked in the studio that night, and he did not take it as seriously as Kennedy did. He spent that afternoon speaking to the Plumbers Union. Kennedy rested up for the debate. Nixon thought it was just another campaign appearance, had no idea what a splash it was going to make in America. He was ill. He'd had a staphylococcus infection. He arrived at the studio at WBBM in Chicago, smacked his knee on the door of the car as he was getting out, was in pain. But what I remember most about that night was over and above the fact, well, first of all, I brought a makeup person from New York. He needed it. Kennedy didn't. I said to the both of them, do you want to be made up? Kennedy said no. Nixon heard him say no and figured, if I get made up, everybody the next day will say, well, Nixon was wearing makeup and Kennedy wasn't. So he refused it, but had some of his own guys smear him with something called shave stick, and he looked like the wrath of God. He really looked terrible.
What was shave stick?
It's some dopey thing that guys use to cover their beard. If you're going out for the night, in the old days before there were electric razors, I mean, what you did is you smeared some of this stuff on and it covered the beard. He looked awful. Now, the day after Kennedy was assassinated, we did a special broadcast in New York, and Nixon was on it. And the same makeup person whose services he had refused in Chicago was making him up. And I said to him, you know, Mr. Nixon, if Franny here had made you up at the first debate, you'd have been president now. Without a beat. I mean, it happened so fast it stunned me. He whirled around and he said to me, yeah, I would have been dead now, too. I mean, it was eerie. It was strange. He really believed that whoever killed Jack Kennedy, and I'm not going to say it was Lee Harvey Oswald because I'm not even sure it was, whoever killed Jack Kennedy, he wanted to convince me was out to get a president, not that president. And it was a strange, strange conversation.
Let me get to the Kennedy assassination. In your book, you say that after Kennedy was assassinated and you found out about the Zapruder film, you told Dan Rather to go to Zapruder's house, punch him in the nose, get the film, bring it to CBS, make a copy, then return it to Zapruder. What were you thinking?
I was one of these, you know, Hildy Johnson, hell for leather. It was stupid. I did things in the early days that if someone who worked for me did them today, I'd fire them. I said, we got to get a hold of the Zapruder film. Maybe it's public domain, but we'll never find out unless we get it. I would like to see it. So I said, Dan, hit him, grab the film, take it to the studio, we'll copy it, then let the CBS lawyers decide what to do with it. Meanwhile, return the film. All they can get you for is an assault. You've returned his stolen property. And he said, great, I'll do it. And then all of a sudden, I thought to myself, are you crazy? Why did you do that? And I thank God when I called him back, he hadn't left yet. And I said, Dan, don't do that. That's stupid. I think the whole day got to me. And I, you know, we were all kind of limp the end of that day.
But I think this says something about you, which is that you really have that competitive thing real strong.
Yeah, really. I guess I am a strong competitor. But But sometimes this competitive zeal causes you to do things that you're, when you look back on them, you're kind of ashamed that you even thought of them.
Great. How about another example?
Oh, my God. Once an airplane went down in the East River off LaGuardia Airport in New York, and there was one tugboat out on the river that you could go out on and go to the wreck because there was a tugboat strike. But this boat had come from New Haven. And I went down with everybody else, and all the television crews were there, and the captain was telling this story of what it was like out on the river and the floating wreckage and the bodies, and he was going on. And I don't know why, but I kind of said, well, who owns this boat? And he said, New Haven Tugboat Company. And all the reporters turned to me like, what are you, crazy? Who cares who owns the boat? This guy's telling us a great story, and you ask a stupid question. And they said, Captain, go on, please go on with your story, and Hewitt, will you shut up with your dumb questions? And as they said that, I sneaked out of the door, went down to the dock, called the CBS newsroom and said, call the New Haven Tugboat Company and charter their boat. So I got back, all the guys saw me come back, and they were all kind of going, don't ask any dumb questions. And at this point, the phone rings. The captain goes to the phone. He says, yes, sir. And then he looks around. He said, who's Hewitt? I said, I am. He said, well, the boat's now under charter to you. What do you want to do? I said, well, first thing I want to do is throw all these guys off my boat. So I was very competitive. And in fact, the only way the Today Show could get any pictures of the wreck was to come out in a rowboat with an outboard motor in the morning, and by mistake, we rammed them. I mean, we really didn't mean to hit them, but we did. And next thing I know, I come back and I get hell because there was a formal complaint from NBC to CBS that I tried to sink their boat in the East River, and all I could think to say was, crybabies.
Now, you say when you started 60 Minutes, you also wanted to create a more personal form of journalism. You write, the documentaries on TV all seem to be the voice of the corporation. What do you mean by that? And what do you mean by a more personal form? Yeah.
Okay. Editorials were the voice of the newspaper, which nobody really cared about. They cared about columnists. And documentaries were sort of the voice of the corporation. You know, NBC White Paper, CBS Reports, ABC Close-Up. And I said, there's nothing personal. And I wanted personal journalism. I don't mean advocacy journalism. I don't think I wanted to advocate anything. I wanted to take people along on the story. And a lot of it came out of a broadcast that was very popular in CBS in the early days. Actually, it wasn't on CBS. I think it was on NBC, called Four Star Theater, in which Dick Powell, Charles Boyer, Ida Lupino, and David Niven had a repertory company, which each week they played different parts, and there was no star. There were just four great actors playing parts. And I said, wow, I'd like to do a repertory company of reporters. I don't want any stars. I don't want an Ed Sullivan out front introducing the acts. I want them to be my version of a repertory company, only these are reporters, not actors. And it caught on. People essentially bought that television set to be entertained. They didn't buy the set to be informed. And I said, if you can entertain them while you're informing them, you're ahead of the game. And it was a concept that caught on.
CBS producer Don Hewitt speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 2001 interview with TV producer and director Don Hewitt, who died this week at the age of 86. Hewitt created the CBS news magazine 60 Minutes.
You always hear rumors about shows. The rumor that I've heard about 60 Minutes, and you can tell me if this is true, is that sometimes the producer of a segment actually does the interview, and then the reporter comes in and is filmed asking those questions, even though they didn't really ask those questions to the person
never,
being interviewed.
Never, 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 ever happened.
Have you ever heard that one?
Oh, we hear everything. Listen, Hillary Clinton, for Christ's sake, after we did the famous Jennifer Flowers thing, she told the Associated Press that we changed all the questions between the time they did it and the time we put on the air. And I called her up and I said, you got to realize she was just another woman, wife of a candidate. And I said, that's libelous. That's defamatory. And she said, well, it appeared to me to be that way. And I figured, sure, it appeared to be that way. She was shell-shocked. I mean, she couldn't believe what, you know, they had to sit there and defend that night. So that has never, ever happened. Nobody has ever changed a question or had a producer ask a question and then later filmed a correspondent asking it.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Clintons interview. How did the Clintons end up on 60 Minutes that night? And what were they expecting? What did they think was in it for them?
What did they think? Oh, my God. They were in trouble. He was about to disappear into the snow in New Hampshire. And they called up and they said they wanted to go on the air and set the record straight about Jennifer Flowers. And for all the time we taped, all they did was set the record crooked. They never set the record straight. And do you know that the right wing, the so-called right wing, because I don't believe in right wing, left wing, but the so-called right wing holds me responsible for his getting the nomination, which he did after that show. Do you know that I'm persona non grata in the Clinton, I was in the Clinton White House? I've been invited to every White House going back to Harry Truman. I was persona non grata with the Clintons. What there was about that, I guess they didn't want to think about that night. But we didn't do anything but give them a chance to answer the questions, and they sat there and fudged everything.
What do you consider the lies that they told that you were referring to?
The lies? I mean, that there never was a Jennifer Flowers and it never happened? Later on, he admitted it.
So if the Clintons came on because they wanted to talk about Jennifer Flowers and deny that there was any truth to that story, what so upset them about the interview?
I don't know. I don't know. It's they claim that I said we would also give you a chance to talk about your vision of America. And I said, no. We thought we were going to do a long piece, and they gave me 9 minutes that night for the whole show because it was after the Super Bowl. And I said, there's no time to do anything but this one story. And if you want to give your vision of America, I'm sure they'll sell you commercial time to do it. But after all, you got to realize at the time, Terry, he was one of five guys trying to get the nomination. He wasn't even the front runner. He was just another candidate trying to get the Democratic nomination.
Let me ask you about one of the many 60 Minutes stories that became very controversial, and this one particularly controversial because a movie was made about it, The Insider. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the case of Jeffrey Wigand, the former vice president for research and development at Brown & Williamson Tobacco, who blew the whistle on how the company had adjusted the levels of nicotine, keeping smokers addicted. And the story was killed at 60 Minutes because of corporate fear of a lawsuit. What kind of lawsuit?
No, it was not killed at 60 Minutes because of corporate fear of a lawsuit. It was killed by the corporation before we ever got a chance to put on the air. But we did go on the air and tell everything we learned from Wigand without using his name. So it's not true that we ran away from that story.
And the way...
The company didn't want us to use his name because they feared a lawsuit. And we actually went on the air, and Mike Wallace actually did something that no news organization has ever done before. He told the audience that we were prohibited from using Wigand's name because CBS had turned chicken and was afraid of a lawsuit, which wasn't even threatened. It was just the perception that it might be.
Was this a very frustrating experience for you watching the movie?
Let me tell you, the God's honest truth.
Yeah.
They'd gotten Paul Newman or Robert Redford to play me, I'd have forgiven them anything.
Yeah, but who did play you?
Some guy named...
Philip Baker Hall.
Philip Baker Hall. I said, not a guy. That's a dormitory.
Yeah, but you ought to retract that statement. He's a great actor. He's fantastic. Did you ever see...
To you, he may be.
Yeah,
to
no, did you ever see Magnolia or Hard Eight? Or...
Yeah, I saw The Insider, and I just... Okay, I said if Paul Newman or Robert Redford had played me, I'd have forgiven him anything.
Well, Philip Baker Hall can play me anytime.
Good. I hope he doesn't for your sake.
Don Hewitt speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 2001. Hewitt died this week. He was 86. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.